Chapter 36. Father and mother, and take your little sister by the hand. We must go straight on now. Good boys don't look after the birds of a Sunday. But, mother, said Marty, you said you'd give half a crown to find the speckled turkey's nest. Mayn't I have the half crown put into my money box? We'll see about that, my lad, if you walk along now, like a good boy. The father and mother exchanged a significant glance of amusement at their eldest born's acuteness, but on Tommy's round face there was a cloud. Mother, he said, half crying, Marty's got ever so much more money in his box nor I've got in mine. Money, me want half a town in my box, said Toddy. Hush, 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 said Mrs. Poyser, did ever anybody hear such naughty children? Nobody shall ever see their money boxes anymore, if they don't make haste, and go on to church. This dreadful threat had the desired effect, and through the two remaining fields the three pair of small legs trotted on without any serious interruption, notwithstanding a small pond full of tadpoles, alias ullheads, which the lads looked at wistfully. The damp hay that must be scattered and turned afresh tomorrow was not a cheering sight to Mr. Poyser, who during hay and corn harvest had often some mental struggles as to the benefits of a day of rest, but no temptation would have induced him to carry on any field work, however early in the morning, on a Sunday, for had not Michael Holdsworth had a pair of oxen weltered while he was plowing on Good Friday? That was a demonstration that work on sacred days was a wicked thing, and with wickedness of any sort Martin Poyser was quite clear that he would have nothing to do, since money got by such means would never prosper. It amost makes your fingers itch to be at the hay now the sun shines so, he observed, as they passed through the ig meadow. But it's poor foolishness to think o' saving by going against your conscience. There's that Jim Wakefield, as they used to call Gentleman Wakefield, apostrophe used to do the same of a Sunday as o' weekdays, and took no heed to right or wrong, as if there was neither God nor devil. And what's he come to? Why, I saw him myself last market day a-carrying a basket why oranges in. Ah, to be sure, said Mrs. Poyser, emphatically, you make but a poor trap to catch luck, if you go and bait it why wickedness. The money as is got so's like to burn holes i' your pocket. I'd never wish us to leave our lads a sixpence, but what was got i' the rightful way. And as for the weather, there's one above makes it, and we must put up wit. It's nothing of a plague to what the wenches are. Notwithstanding the interruption in their walk, the excellent habit which Mrs. Poyser's clock had of taking time by the forelock had secured their arrival at the village while it was still a quarter to two, though almost everyone who meant to go to church was already within the churchyard gates. Those who stayed at home were chiefly mothers, like Timothy's Bess, who stood at her own door nursing her baby, and feeling as women feel in that position, that nothing else can be expected of them. It was not entirely to see Thias Bede's funeral that the people were standing about the churchyard so long before service began. That was their common practice. The women, indeed, usually entered the church at once, and the farmers' wives talked in an undertone to each other, over the tall pews, about their illnesses and the total failure of doctor's stuff, recommending dandelion tea, and other homemade specifics, as far preferable about the servants, and their growing exorbitance as to wages, whereas the quality of their services declined from year to year, and there was no girl nowadays to be trusted any further than you could see her about the bad price Mr. Dingle, the Treddleston grocer, was giving for butter, and the reasonable doubts that might be held as to his solvency, notwithstanding that Mrs. Dingle was a sensible woman, and they were all sorry for her, for as he had very good kin. Meantime the men lingered outside, and hardly any of them except the singers, who had a humming and fragmentary rehearsal to go through, entered the church until Mr. Irwin was in the desk. They saw no reason for that premature entrance. What could they do in church if they were there before service began? and they did not conceive that any power in the universe could take it ill of them if they stayed out and talked a little about usness. Chad Cranage looks like quite a new acquaintance today, for he has got his clean Sunday face, which always makes his little granddaughter cry at him as a stranger. But an experienced eye would have fixed on him at once as the village blacksmith, after seeing the humble deference with which the big saucy fellow took off his hat and stroked his hair to the farmers. For Chad was accustomed to say that a working man must hold a candle to a personage understood to be as black as he was himself on weekdays, by which evil-sounding rule of conduct he meant what was, after all, rather virtuous than otherwise, namely, that men who had horses, to be shod must be treated with respect. Chad and the rougher sort of workman kept aloof from the grave under the white thorn, where the burial was going forward. But Sandy Jim, and several of the farm laborers, made a group round it, and stood with their hats off, as fellow mourners with the mother and sons. Others held a midway position, sometimes watching the group at the grave, sometimes listening to the conversation of the farmers, who stood in a knot near the church door, and were now joined by Martin Poyser, while his family passed into the church. On the outside of this knot stood Mr. Casson, the landlord of the Donnithorne Arms, in his most striking attitude, that is to say, with the forefinger of his right hand thrust between the buttons of his waistcoat, his left hand in his breeches pocket, and his head very much on one side, looking, on the whole, like an actor who has only a monosyllabic part entrusted to him, but feels sure that the audience discern his fitness for the leading business. Curiously in contrast with old Jonathan Birch, who held his hands behind him and leaned forward, coughing asthmatically, with an inward scorn of all knowingness that could not be turned into cash. The talk was in rather a lower tone than usual today, hushed a little by the sound of Mr. Irwin's voice reading the final prayers of the burial service. They had all had their word of pity for poor Thias, but now they had got upon the nearer subject of their own grievances against Satchel, the squire's bailiff, who played the part of steward so far as it was not performed by old Mr. Donnithorne himself, for that gentleman had the meanness to receive his own rents and make bargains about his own timber. This subject of conversation was an additional reason for not being loud, since Satchel himself might presently be walking up the paved road to the church door. And soon they became suddenly silent, for Mr. Irwin's voice had ceased, and the group round the white thorn was dispersing itself towards the church. They all moved aside, and stood with their hats off, while Mr. Irwin passed. Adam and Seth were coming next, with their mother between them. For Joshua Rann officiated as head sexton as well as clerk, and was not yet ready to follow the rector into the vestry. But there was a pause before the three mourners came on. Lisbeth had turned round to look again towards the grave. Ah! There was nothing now but the brown earth under the white thorn. Yet she cried less today than as he had done any day since her husband's death. Along with all her grief there was mixed an unusual sense of her own importance in having a Uriel, and in Mr. Irwin's reading a special service for her husband, and besides, she knew the funeral psalm was going to be sung for him. She felt this counter-excitement to her sorrow still more strongly as she walked with her sons towards the church door, and saw the friendly sympathetic nods of their fellow parishioners. The mother and sons passed into the church, and one by one the loiterers followed, though some still lingered without. The sight of Mr. Donnithorne's carriage, which was winding slowly up the hill, perhaps helping to make them feel that there was no need for haste. But presently the sound of the bassoon and the key bugles burst forth. The evening hymn, which always opened the service, had begun, and everyone must now enter and take his place. I cannot say that the interior of Hayslope Church was remarkable for anything except for the gray age of its oaken pews, great square pews mostly, ranged on each side of a narrow aisle. It was free, indeed, from the modern blemish of galleries. The choir had two narrow pews to themselves in the middle of the right-hand row, so that it was a short process for Joshua Rann to take his place among them as principal bass, and return to his desk after the singing was over. The pulpit and desk, gray and old as the pews, stood on one side of the arch leading into the chancel, which also had its gray square pews for Mr. Donathan's family and servants. Yet I assure you these gray pews, with the buff-washed walls, gave a very pleasing tone to this shabby interior, and agreed extremely well with the ruddy faces and bright waistcoats. And there were liberal touches of crimson toward the chancel, for the pulpit and Mr. Donathan's own pew had handsome crimson cloth cushions, and, to close the vista, there was a crimson altar cloth, embroidered with golden rays by Miss Lydia's own hand. But even without the crimson cloth, the effect must have been warm and cheering when Mr. Irwin was in the desk, looking benignly round on that simple congregation on the hardy old men, with bent knees and shoulders, perhaps, but with vigor left for much hedge clipping and thatching, on the tall stalwart frames and roughly cut bronzed faces of the stone cutters and carpenters, on the half-dozen well-to-do farmers, with their apple-cheeked families, and on the clean old women, mostly farm laborers' wives, with their bit of snow-white cap border under their black bonnets, and with their withered arms, bare from the elbow, folded passively over their chests. For none of the old people held books, why should they? Not one of them could read. But they knew a few good words by heart, and their withered lips now and then moved silently, following the service without any very clear comprehension indeed, but with a simple faith in its efficacy, to ward off harm and bring blessing. And now all faces were visible, for all were standing up, the little children on the seats peeping over the edge of the gray pews, while good Bishop Ken's evening hymn was being sung to one of those lively psalm tunes which died out with the last generation of rectors and choral parish clerks. Melodies die out, like the pipe of Pan, with the ears that love them and listen for them. Adam was not in his usual place among the singers today, for he sat with his mother and Seth, and he noticed with surprise that Bartle Massey was absent, to all the more agreeable for Mr. Joshua Rann, who gave out his bass notes with unusual complacency, and threw an extra ray of severity into the glances he sent over his spectacles at the recusant Will Maskery. I beseech you to imagine Mr. Irwin looking round on this scene, in his ample white surplice that became him so well, with his powdered hair thrown back, his rich brown complexion, and his finely cut nostril and upper lip. For there was a certain virtue in that benignant yet keen countenance as there is in all human faces from which a generous soul beams out. And over all, streamed the delicious June sunshine through the old windows, with their desultory patches of yellow, red, and blue, that threw pleasant touches of color on the opposite wall. I think, as Mr. Irwin looked round today, his eyes rested an instant longer than usual on the square pew occupied by Martin Poyser and his family. And there was another pair of dark eyes that found it impossible not to wander thither and rest on that round pink and white figure. But Hetty was at that moment quite careless of any glances. She was absorbed in the thought that Arthur Donathan would soon be coming into church, for the carriage must surely be at the church gate by this time. As he had never seen him since she parted with him in the wood on Thursday evening, and oh, how long the time had seemed! Things had gone on just the same as ever since that evening. The wonders that had happened then had brought no changes after them. They were already like a dream. When she heard the church door swinging, her heart beat so, she dared not look up. She felt that her aunt was curtsying. She curtsied herself. That must be old Mr. Donathan. He always came first, the wrinkled small old man, peering round with short-sighted glances at the bowing and curtsying congregation. Then she knew Miss Lydia was passing, and though Hetty liked so much to look at her fashionable little coal scuttle bonnet, with the wreath of small roses round it, she didn't mind it today. But there were no more curtsies. No, he was not come. She felt sure there was nothing else passing the pew door but the housekeeper's black bonnet and the lady's maid's beautiful straw hat that had once been Miss Lydia's, and then the powdered heads of the butler and footman. No, he was not there. Yet she would look now she might be mistaken, for, after all, she had not looked. So she lifted up her eyelids, and glanced timidly at the cushioned pew in the chancel. There was no one, but old Mr. Donathan rubbing his spectacles with his white handkerchief, and Miss Lydia opening the large gilt-edged prayer book. The chill disappointment was too hard to bear. She felt herself turning pale, her lips trembling. She was ready to cry. Oh, what should she do? Everybody would know the reason. They would know she was crying, because Arthur was not there. And Mr. Craig, with the wonderful hothouse plant in his buttonhole, was staring at her, she knew. It was dreadfully long before the general confession began, so that she could kneel down. Two great drops would fall then, but no one saw them except good-natured Molly, for her aunt and uncle knelt with their backs towards her. Molly, unable to imagine any cause for tears in church except faintness, of which as he had a vague traditional knowledge, drew out of her pocket a queer little flat blue-smelling bottle, and after much labor in pulling the cork out, thrust the narrow neck against Teddy's nostrils. "Tea donna smell," she whispered, thinking this was a great advantage which old salts had over fresh ones. "They did you good without biting your nose." Teddy pushed it away peevishly, but this little flash of temper did what the salts could not have done. It roused her to wipe away the traces of her tears, and try with all her might not to shed any more. Teddy had a certain strength in her vain little nature. She would have borne anything rather than be laughed at or pointed at with any other feeling than admiration. She would have pressed her own nails into her tender flesh, rather than people should know a secret she did not want them to know. What fluctuations there were in her busy thoughts and feelings, while Mr. Irwin was pronouncing the solemn solution in her deaf ears, and through all the tones of petition that followed. Anger lay very close to disappointment, and soon won the victory over the conjectures her small ingenuity could devise to account for Arthur's absence on the supposition that he really wanted to come, really wanted to see her again. And by the time she rose from her knees mechanically, because all the rest were rising, the color had returned to her cheeks even with a heightened glow, for she was framing little indignant speeches to herself, saying she hated Arthur for giving her this pain she would like him to suffer too. Yet while this selfish tumult was going on in her soul, her eyes were bent down on her prayer book, and the eyelids with their dark fringe looked as lovely as ever. Adam Bede thought so, as he glanced at her for a moment on rising from his knees. But Adam's thoughts of Hetty did not deafen him to the service. They rather blended with all the other deep feelings for which the church service was a channel to him this afternoon, as a certain consciousness of our entire past and our imagined future blends itself with all our moments of keen sensibility. And to Adam the church service was the best channel he could have found for his mingled regret, yearning, and resignation. Its interchange of beseeching cries for help with outbursts of faith and praise, its recurrent responses and the familiar rhythm of its collects, seemed to speak for him as no other form of worship could have done. As, to those early Christians who had worshipped from their childhood upwards in catacombs, the torchlight and shadows must have seemed nearer the divine presence than the heathenish. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.